maintain and deter Saddam with economic sanctions and diplomacy. Through the CIA, it was trying to overthrow him. Bullshit, Saul said. The only way to succeed was for the CIA to support a full military invasion of Iraq. In the first months after 9/11, Iraq took a back seat, though Vice President Cheney asked the CIA to brief him on what they could do. Saul did not soft-pedal his message. The CIA would not be the solution. The CIA officers then gave the same briefing to the president. "Could we do it by covert means?" the president asked. The answer was no. "Darn," the president recalled thinking. "There didn't seem to be a sucker punch." To the agency's objection to a bifurcated policy of moving toward war while continuing diplomacy through the UN, Bush said that that was the way it was going to be. "I know I put you in a difficult position," the president said. "I know this is hard, but this is the course we're on, and we're going to have to keep doing all of these elements at the same time." For Condoleezza Rice, this was one of the tough dilemmas, working two tracks and having to act and speak forcefully and convincingly about both. Coercive diplomacy meant living with dissonance and inconsistencies, she realized. The CIA made it clear that in order to recruit sources inside Iraq, they would have to say the U.S. was serious and was coming with its military. The president's body language suggested he had received the message, but he didn't make any promises. When Powell was told all of this, he concluded that the CIA just didn't want another fuck-up. Powell realized that when someone says they can't do something, but, oh, they can support the other guys, it created another substantial pressure for war. Powell had served two tours in Vietnam as a junior officer where he'd seen failure up close. Now, in 2001, from Washington and the Pentagon and the White House, and even his own State Department, war seemed antiseptic, and at times like a great game. Powell knew deeply, intimately, that war is fought by kids, even teenagers who would die because of decisions made in Washington. The top echelon of the Bush administration was noticeably free of those who had seen combat. During his time as Joint Chiefs Chairman, he had loosely formulated a Powell Doctrine. It was commonly stated that he meant the military should use overwhelming force to guarantee success in any use of force in any operation. He felt it had been caricatured and had cast him as the reluctant warrior, unwilling to take any chances, eager to avoid limited military engagements. Actually, his doctrine was a bit more subtle. The military should use decisive force to achieve political objectives. Powell had another problem to contend with. After nearly a year as Secretary of State, he had not achieved a personal relationship with President Bush. As Secretary, he found himself often frozen out by the White House, in the icebox or the refrigerator, as he and his deputy Richard Armitage often joked. In fact, before 9/11, the administration's foreign policy was pretty much a muddle. The president was focused on domestic and tax issues, and there was no clear direction. Powell also noticed that Bush had listened respectfully to the polo step briefing in Crawford, asked some general factual questions, but tended not to be very probing, he thought. Bush was not drilling down. Troubled by what was being planned and how, Powell reached out to General Franks. Powell, who had been chairman of the Joint Chiefs when the original Op Plan 1003 was devised, voiced deep concern to Franks that the military would allow itself to be talked into a smaller force than necessary. Recent talk of having a ground force of only 105,000, one-fifth the size of the old Op Plan 1003, was preposterous, out of the question. Franks made it clear that he was first a military officer and had no intention of losing a war on his watch. On January 17, 2002, Franks and Renouard appeared before Rumsfeld to present the fourth iteration of their planning. The new plan called for just a single front, a ground thrust into southern Iraq from Kuwait, then northward into Baghdad. Franks raised the possibility of a second front in the north attacking from Turkey. Franks had an answer to the astonishing question Rumsfeld had posed the previous month of what could be done quickly as early as April or May. The minimum ground force to start would be about 105,000, Franks said. It would take 30 to 45 days to move those forces to the region. So if you think you want to do this in April, you need to let me start moving forces in mid-February. That was in 4 weeks. Back in Tampa during this period, Franks realized that large movements of divisions or aircraft carriers, all necessary ingredients for war, were going to be very visible. As part of the influence operations, he decided, they would engage in calculated deception. He called this notion spikes. They could send more force and get media attention and interest, and then things would go back to normal, nothing would happen, and the focus would spike down. The idea was to play with Saddam's head, to raise and lower expectations of an attack. Rumsfeld liked the idea. Sitting in his small West Wing office with a structural pillar squarely in the middle, presidential speechwriter Michael Gerson pored over an 8-page outline of the upcoming State of the Union speech he had given the president just before Christmas. The president had said he wanted an ambitious speech. He would set out the new rules of the game and the direction he was heading in foreign policy. This clearly was not like the World War II period, Gerson thought, when an American president could wait for the enemy to attack and then respond. He anticipated they could lay out this formulation most explicitly for the first time in the State of the Union. Gerson's friendly manner, with a bit of the nervous, absent-minded professor about him, masks a keen intellect, drive, and sharp ear for the memorable phrase. Gerson, who, like Bush, is a self-described evangelical Christian and compassionate conservative, admired the way that Bush didn't shy away from injecting his religious convictions and moral conclusions into speeches. He had worked hard on the State of the Union outline, pulling together a lot of research. He asked David Frum, a respected conservative author on his staff, to come up with a sentence or two summing up the case for going after Iraq. Frum thought that the relationship Bush was seeking to establish between Saddam Hussein's regime and 9/11 lay in the nexus of states that sponsored terrorism and terrorists who did not have allegiance to one state. He called it an axis of hatred. He singled out Iraq by name in his proposal. It was a nice phrase with overtones of the World War II Axis powers. Gerson changed Frum's phrase, axis of hatred, to axis of evil, broadening the notion, making it more sinister, even wicked. It was almost as if Saddam was an agent of the devil. The connection between his regime with weapons of mass destruction and international terrorism could put the world on the road to Armageddon. When Rice read an early draft, she was pleased that the president would be raising the connection between weapons of mass destruction and terrorism. Calling the connection an axis was clever, and calling it an axis of evil was most clever, she thought. Rice and her deputy, Stephen Hadley, were aware of the secret war planning on Iraq, and they worried that singling out Iraq as the embodiment of the axis of evil would appear to be a declaration of war. Rice was keeping tabs on what was by then a favorite parlor game in Washington. When does the Iraq war start? So she and Hadley suggested adding other countries. North Korea and Iran were the clear candidates because both supported terrorism and pursued weapons of mass destruction. The president liked the idea of the three countries, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. But Hadley had second thoughts about including Iran. The country had a complicated political structure with a democratically elected president. No, the president said. I want it in. Iran would stay. In an interview later, the president recalled he had specific reasons. It is very important for the American president at this point in history to speak very clearly about the evils the world faces. No question about it, North Korea, Iraq, and Iran are the biggest threats to peace at the time. Iran was unique, he said, because there is a freedom movement in Iran and because Iran is relatively open compared to other countries that are run by, you know, theocratic people, because of the internet, the diaspora here from the United States and Iran. And the fact that the President of the United States would stand up and say Iran is just like Iraq and North Korea, in other words, you've got a problem. The Iranians, we know you've got a problem. We hear you got a problem. And the president is willing to call it as part of how you deal with Iran. And that is to inspire those who love freedom inside the country. Asked how he thought the Iranians might respond to being called part of an evil axis, Bush said, I doubt the students and the reformers and the liberators inside Iran were displeased with that. I made the calculation that they would be pleased. Up here, the president speaks so clearly about the nature of the regime and the harshness and the repression they have to live under. Now, I'm confident the leaders didn't like it. Let me make you understand what I just said about the role of the United States. I believe the United States is the beacon for freedom in the world, and I believe we have a responsibility to promote freedom that is as solemn as the responsibility is to protecting the American people, because the two go hand in hand. No, it's very important for you to understand that about my presidency. I reminded him that in the summer of 2002, before the Iraq War, we had discussed this when he said, I will seize the opportunity to achieve big goals. I don't mean to be grinding on you, he said. I say that freedom is not America's gift to the world. Freedom is God's gift to everybody in the world. I believe that. As a matter of fact, I was the person that wrote the line. Or said it. I didn't write it. I just said it in a speech. And it became part of the jargon. And I believe that. And I believe we have a duty to free people. I would hope we wouldn't have to do it militarily, but we have a duty. I asked whether such a conviction translated into policy that could seem dangerously paternalistic to people in other countries. Unless you're the person that happens to be liberated, he said, adding that he wanted to work with other world leaders on this liberation strategy, such as the leaders of Britain, Spain, and Australia. Tony Blair, Jose Maria Aznar, John Howard all share that same zeal for freedom. It probably looks paternalistic to some elites, but it certainly is not paternalistic to those we free. Those who become free appreciate the zeal and appreciate the passion. As Gerson progressed with drafts of the State of the Union, he was happy that they had found strong language. Bush was still baffled about the countries that produced ideologies and people with the goal of killing Americans in terrorist attacks. He wondered how the U.S. could reform such societies and wanted to advocate the promotion of democracy and women's rights in the Muslim world. No president had said that before. It was part of the change in the president's thinking and the world that Gerson had witnessed since the 9/11 attacks. In his opinion, a change as fundamental as the beginnings of the Cold War. So language about promoting democratic and other human values was added to the speech. Karl Rove, Bush's senior advisor and political strategist, took no direct part in the decision process for war planning, but he sat in on the speech preparation sessions with the president. He thought that axis of evil was a signature phrase, a declaration that U.S. foreign policy had changed, that the country now would have a great mission. It was big, new, and different, Rove believed. The war on terror was going to be extended to rogue nations, and the list would be the dominant foreign policy issue for as long as Bush was president. With the axis of evil statement, Rove believed that Bush was telling the country, we can't go back to sleep again. 3 or 4 days before the president was to deliver the speech, the White House sent drafts to the State Department for review. On the drafts that Powell and Armitage reviewed, the axis of evil line had the three countries listed. We'll have to explain this one, Powell said to Armitage. But the phrase didn't strike either of them as a problem. The State of the Union address before the joint session of the Congress is an annual nationally televised ritual that draws a giant audience. Nearly 52 million Americans watched the primetime speech on Tuesday, January 29th. Bush devoted one sentence to North Korea, one to Iran, and five to Iraq. The president read 63 long paragraphs for 48 minutes. Rice was sure the headline would be about Bush's desire for democracy and political change in the Middle East, something she believed had never been emphasized by an American president before. The news media seized on the axis of evil phrase. Were the three countries somehow linked in a way that was not previously known? Was it Bush's war list? The White House put out word that war was not imminent. In the White House communications shop, Dan Bartlett, the director, was delighted. What a phrase, a mere five syllables. Good versus evil worked. Powell was surprised by the intense focus on the line and soon realized that it might turn into a to-do list for some time to come. There was lots of grumbling in the diplomatic community. The words were ringing bells of alarm all over the world. So at a senior staff meeting 2 days after the speech, he raised the subject. The words of the president were policy, Powell said. That's it. We heard it. There is nothing more to discuss or debate. He did not want anyone offering their interpretation or qualification, going out saying, what the president meant to say was. The phrase served a dual purpose for Bush. On one hand, it sounded tough. Since Reagan, no president had so blatantly rattled the sword. On the other hand, the speech blurred the focus by including North Korea and Iran, providing additional cover for the secret planning for covert action in Iraq and war. Rumsfeld wasn't wasting time. On Friday, February 1st, 3 days after the State of the Union speech, he had Franks back at the Pentagon. Op Plan 1003 was now called the Generated Start Plan. The force for going to war would be fully generated in the region before war commenced. Franks, however, had halved the period before commencing combat from 180 to 90 days, a big improvement. They also began discussion of how they might compress the time for the initial force buildup, enabling a running start because of the invisible covert efforts underway. The secretary continued to pepper the general with questions, constantly raising the bar of expectation. Rumsfeld was like a dentist drill that never ceased. Thursday, February 7th, the president and his national security team met in the Situation Room. Franks presented the refined Generated Start plan for war with Iraq. It was the first time Bush saw an actual plan that he could order carried out. Under this plan, war with Iraq would take 225 days. Franks used the term 90-45-90, meaning 90 days of preparation and force movement to the point when war would start, and 45 days of serious bombing prior to the major ground operations. At the end of these 45 days, the full force would be there, some 300,000, and it would take another 90 days to complete decisive combat operations to remove the regime. Franks then displayed a chart called Timings. Clearly, the best times militarily were roughly December 1st through February 2003, Franks said. Bush agreed. Can you go later? Rumsfeld asked. We can go anytime the President of the United States says to go, Franks replied. But can you go earlier? Rumsfeld pressed. We can go anytime the President chooses, the General replied. If we had to, the President asked. Could we go earlier? Mr. President, we can go earlier, Franks answered. What would that mean? What it would mean is it would be ugly, Franks said. Bush laughed. Well, what does that mean? The war could take longer and U.S. casualties could be higher. Going later could also create problems, weather for one. Franks said there was still a lot of work to be done. Most immediate, he said, they needed to focus on preparatory tasks. He also explained the notion of spikes. Franks planned many, many spikes, feints calculated to deceive. Rumsfeld, for the first time, introduced the concept of shock and awe to the president. At this point, it meant building up so much force and conducting various spiking operations and bombing that it might in itself trigger regime change. The president chuckled a little bit. Shock and awe, he noted, was a catchy notion. Was it a gimmick, he wondered. The meeting lasted 1 hour and 10 minutes. Franks once again felt it had been a great briefing. He had some time before war. Clearly Bush absorbed the magnitude of the problem and the requirement for a robust force. There was no doing this on the cheap. Powell, too, thought the briefing had gone well. No one seemed trigger-happy. Cheney thought the war plan took too long to unfold. Anything that gave Saddam time might mean he could mine the oil wells or use weapons of mass destruction, attacking American troops with chemical weapons or his own troops with the intent of blaming the Americans. Or Saddam might retain his unconventional weapons for later use. He needed to be ousted, or at minimum sealed up, with all available speed. Andy Card, the president's chief of staff, who also was privy to the briefing, concluded that the military was not ready. Franks was talking frameworks and ideas, not much more. Card also worried that Iraq was every general's dream of war, a traditional battlefield, big complex plans with wheeling corps, thousands of air sorties, and battalions of tanks rumbling across the desert. As General George Patton had said while surveying the battlefield, "I love it. God help me, I do love it." Terrorism, especially Al-Qaeda, was still the center of Tenet's universe. The Iraq operations chief, Saul, had met with Rumsfeld on February 1st to outline a covert action plan to support the U.S. military in regime change operations in Iraq. Saul was discovering that the CIA reporting sources inside Iraq were pretty thin. "I can count them on one hand," Saul said, pausing for effect, "and I can still pick my nose." There were four, and those sources were in Iraqi ministries such as Foreign Affairs and Oil that were on the periphery of any penetration of Saddam's inner circle. Recruiting Iraqis was hard, Saul was learning. The CIA could offer someone from $5,000 to $10,000 a month, big money, to have him commit espionage. The risk was arrest, probably watching his wife and daughter raped in front of him, the murder of his sons, the bulldozing of his house, other unimaginable tortures. What was $10,000 a month in the face of that? The only viable way to recruit new sources inside Iraq would be a clear demonstration that the U.S. was absolutely serious and was coming in full force to depose Saddam once and for all. With Tenet's approval, Saul, McLaughlin, and Jim Pavitt, the deputy director for operations, worked on a new top-secret intelligence order for regime change in Iraq that President Bush signed on February 16th. The cost was set at $200 million a year for 2 years. After some disputes in Congress, the budget was cut to $189 million for the first year. Afghanistan had demonstrated the importance of having paramilitary teams inside the country. Solid on-the-ground intelligence and effective lethal operations could not be done from the sidelines. On February 20th, 4 days after the finding was signed, a CIA survey team secretly entered northern Iraq in the Kurdish area to prepare for the deployment of CIA paramilitary teams that would be called Nile. Northern Iraqi Liaison Elements. On Thursday, February 28th, Franks arrived at Rumsfeld's office at the Pentagon bearing two Manhattan telephone book-sized top-secret binders of nearly 4,000 possible targets in Iraq. The targets, culled almost exclusively from the latest overhead satellite imagery, ranged from serious leadership, security and military concentrations, down to Iraqi infantry and armor maneuver companies and air defense units in the field. Rumsfeld was surprised and pleased at the large number. What sort of attack and bombing campaign might have the biggest impact on the regime? What might cause the regime to crumble? Vice President Cheney told General Franks that he was planning a trip to the Middle East in March and asked what countries he should visit. who might be ripe for solicitation, pressure to assist in a war against Iraq. They agreed on at least 10 potential countries: Egypt, Oman, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Bahrain, Qatar, Jordan, Israel, and Turkey. On March 6th, Franks briefed Cheney in Washington. The general had a top-secret paper that he had worked out with Rumsfeld on what was needed from each country. Cheney's mission was to turn up the pressure in each country to make a sounding of how their leaders felt about Iraq. His message to the leaders was that if the United States were to use force, they would be serious about it. Cheney was in luck in Jordan, where Tenet had virtually bought the Jordanian intelligence service, less so in Egypt, where President Hosni Mubarak was resistant. On one leg of Cheney's tour, it was three countries in a single day, including Qatar, a key ally that would provide staging and a headquarters. It was a blur, and it was hard. Lynn Cheney, the vice president's wife, had a two-hour lunch with the favorite wife of the emir of Qatar. "When do kids start school here in Bahrain?" Mrs. Cheney inquired. "This isn't Bahrain," the wife replied. The trip was something of a wake-up call for the vice president. The leaders pounded on him not about Iraq or the threat of Saddam Hussein or terrorism, but about the Middle East peace process. He kept hearing that the president had better get involved and throw his weight around to set the region on some process to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This was a message that Powell had been sending to the White House nonstop. Franks was of like mind. March 21st, Franks gathered the component commanders of the services, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines, at Ramstein Air Base in Germany, a large U.S. and NATO airlift installation. Franks was poised for war. He was convinced that they were going to do this. By "do this," he meant either Saddam Hussein and his family were going to leave and turn his country over, or the president was going to war. Would Saddam and his family leave? As a practical matter, he concluded that the answer was no. "Fellas, there's a burglar in the house," Franks told his commanders in a closed session. In other words, this was not an abstract planning exercise. Don't advertise something that you can't deliver. During this period, Saul went to Tampa to brief Franks on the covert action program the CIA would be undertaking against Iraq. "You know," Franks said, "I fought these people before." As a brigadier general, he had been assistant division commander, maneuver, of the 1st Cavalry Division in the Gulf War. "I took my measure of them. I'm not worried." "Okay," Saul replied. "You know your business. That's what you get paid for." At another meeting with the component commanders, Franks urged them on. "This is fucking serious. You know, if you guys think this is not going to happen, you're wrong. You need to get off your ass." In March, Tenet met secretly with two individuals who would be critical to covert action inside Iraq, Massoud Barzani and Jalal Talabani, the leaders of the two main Kurdish groups in northern Iraq. Tenet had one message: the United States was serious, the military and the CIA were coming. Tenet had a giant lever: money. He could pay millions, tens of millions of dollars in U.S. $100 bills. Tenet had told Bush that some money was going to be paid on speculation in order to establish relationships and demonstrate seriousness, and that not all of it might look like it had been well spent. It was like chum, small pieces of fish scattered on the water to attract the big ones. In intelligence, you often had to chum far and wide. The Bushes hosted British Prime Minister Tony Blair and his family at their ranch in Crawford over the weekend of April 6th and 7th. In an interview with the United Kingdom's ITV television network, reporter Trevor MacDonald pushed the president about Iraq. "I made up my mind that Saddam needs to go," Bush said. "That's about all I'm willing to share with you." "And how are you going to achieve this, Mr. President?" "Wait and see." Eventually, the prodding took Bush into dangerous territory as he added, "And I have no plans to attack on my desk." Though technically true, it obscured the direct and personal nature of his involvement in the war planning. Franks gave Rumsfeld an update on April 11th by secure video. Initial preparations would cost in the range of perhaps $300 million to $400 million. Reacting to the sticker shock, Rumsfeld wondered aloud if there were any way to get other countries to foot some of this bill. Just more than a week later, April 20th, Franks briefed the president in a Saturday session at Camp David. "I'm feeling a little bit better about the small, lighter, more accelerated concept," Frank said. "It seemed to be coming together. Mr. President, I am probably going to be able to reduce the time about one-third from what I thought initially. At the end of that period, they would have about 180,000 people deployed. If they did not meet with immediate success, the force would grow to about 250,000 by the end of decisive combat operations." "Don't take these numbers, Mr. President, to be what we'll execute. This just happens to be where we are right now." "You tell me, Tommy, what it takes to do this," the president said. "Obviously, I want to make sure we do this right and quickly." Frank saw the problem. Of course, right and quickly might not be the same thing. Making it quick might in fact be wrong. He took this as what he called a presidential hint, and a very loose one at that. The general said, "I'm going to have to balance risk before I tell you that I have a plan that I'm ready to execute." Key questions, he said, were, "How much force is necessary to be built up over what period of time so that when it begins it doesn't last long?" And, "How long does it have to go before you are decisive and get it finished?" "Yep," the president said, "exactly right. Tommy, you are my expert. You got to tell me what it takes to do it. Anything you need, you'll have." At another point, Bush added, "If this goes a long time, Dick Cheney says that the region is going to be problematic." That was a nice word for disaster. Another presidential hint. The president then added, "It's going to have to go however long it's going to go, but I just thought I'd say that." Later, Bush recalled that he was indeed trying to send hints. "Very important for a president not to micromanage a war plan to suit, one, domestic politics, and two, the international politics. On the other hand, as Tommy planned, I wanted him to understand some of the nuances, or understand issues in a nuanced way. The worst thing a president can do is to say, 'Oh no, the war plan must conform to a political calendar.' It is very delicate for the president to deal with his generals. He must be very careful. They take everything," the president said, and then restarted. "This is a command structure where when the president says something, it is taken extremely seriously by everybody up and down the chain of command, and so I'm mindful of that." So he was sending hints without jeopardizing what Franks wanted to do. "Remember this, if a president tries to design a war plan, he puts his soldiers at risk, because I'm a lousy war plan designer." President Bush flew to Europe for meetings with German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder on May 23rd and French President Jacques Chirac on May 26th. At press conferences in each capital, the president told the two key continental European allies, "I have no war plans on my desk." That week, in a misleading public statement, General Franks went further. Asked at a news conference in Tampa on May 21st what force would be needed to invade Iraq and how long it would take, the CENTCOM commander said, "That's a great question and one for which I don't have an answer because my boss has not yet asked me to put together a plan to do that." He added, "They have not asked me for those kinds of numbers." Well-wired Pentagon reporters knew Iraq war planning was going on in some way. But sources in the Pentagon, particularly those not privy to the Rumsfeld-Franks sessions, told the reporters that Franks' work amounted to nothing more than a concept of operations and did not constitute a plan. At the same time, Franks was improving his position below the radar, approaching the point where he would soon have two brigades on the ground in Kuwait and pre-positioned equipment for four brigades. Early Saturday morning, June 1st, Chief speechwriter Michael Gerson accompanied the president aboard the Marine One helicopter up the Hudson River to West Point, New York, where Bush was to give the commencement address at the United States Military Academy. Gerson believed this was the most important speech he had ever worked on, and he wanted to be there. It grew out of an almost grandiose purpose Bush had found in the presidency since 9/11. Gerson recognized the bedrock American hesitancy, even extreme reluctance to be involved in the world. To change that, the country had to be convinced that both its security interests and its ideals were in jeopardy. The goal was no less than to change the American mindset the same way it had been changed at the beginning of the Cold War. The Axis of Evil speech had identified the possible target countries. Now Bush would specify the means, preemption. The argument was as follows. If the United States deferred action, hesitated at striking those who were threats, the consequences might not be immediate. But the prospect of losing half the population of an American city was so horrible to contemplate that it created an urgent duty. Gerson knew that Cheney had been raising these questions about the potential threat of terrorists acquiring weapons of mass destruction since the 2000 campaign. Since 9/11, it had become Cheney's obsession. Iraq was merely the greatest possible source of connecting such weapons and terrorism. The president told Gerson that he did not want to play what he called small ball. He had decided that in the future, the U.S. would strike preemptively at threats, rather than rely on containment or deterrence. "The war on terror will not be won on the defensive," Bush told nearly 1,000 graduating cadets and their families in West Point's Mikey Stadium. "We must take the battle to the enemy, disrupt his plans, and confront the worst threats before they emerge." Afterward, Gerson told a reporter, "You know, this speech is going to be quoted for a long time. You have to pay a lot of attention to this." "There's no news in that speech," the reporter replied. "You don't use the word Iraq." Gerson was stunned. Here Bush had laid out the basis of his entire national security and foreign policy strategy. Rumsfeld didn't find much new in the speech. He had been talking publicly about preemption since 9/11. In the 16th century, Sir Thomas More discussed preemption in his Utopia. The idea that when you know there is going to be an attack that will come from a neighbor, you shouldn't just wait for it. You should go and do something. It just seemed common sense. In Rumsfeld's and Frank's nonstop dialogue, they kept returning to the notion of smaller and quicker. Not only did they have to deal with the possibility that Saddam might act provocatively, but suppose that the president, for one reason or another, wanted to prevent Iraq from doing something, wanted to put his preemptive doctrine into practice, and needed a quick option, say, tomorrow or next month. On June 3rd, via secure video, Franks presented Rumsfeld with what he called the running start, beginning war before all the U.S. forces were in the region and ready. Rumsfeld liked the concept of a running start and directed that it be pursued. On the secure video, Franks presented a new concept for dealing with a fortress Baghdad. He called it from the inside out, meaning that his forces would aggressively attack and eliminate Saddam's command and control, and also launch against Iraqi divisions closest to the city. This would be designed to preclude large numbers of Iraqi forces from immediately massing into the center of Baghdad. On Wednesday, June 19th, Franks presented the latest to Bush. He assured the president they would win. "Most important," Franks said, as a result of looking at more what-ifs, Rumsfeld and he had come up with a new flexible response option, a kind of running start. Because he would start deploying more forces at the moment the president ordered air operations, he could get another 2 divisions into Kuwait within 2 to 3 weeks. That meant he could have a little over 100,000 for a ground attack within about 30 days. Bush's response was neutral. He seemed to accept the logic of another option. He asked Franks to work hard on plans to respond if Saddam used weapons of mass destruction, either against neighbors or U.S. forces. How was the general equipped to preclude it or defend against it, or in the worst case, operate in a contaminated environment? The president was keen that Rumsfeld and Franks get on with the interagency support to make sure they completed the preparatory tasks for supplies, basing, and fuel in the region. He seemed to be conveying a sense of urgency. The big muscle movement was for airfields and fuel infrastructure in Kuwait, where a massive covert public works program had already been launched. All of this was so far below the radar that the Kuwaitis, let alone the Iraqis, seemed not to notice. Later, the president praised Rumsfeld and Franks for this strategy of moving troops in and expanding the infrastructure. "It was, in my judgment," Bush said, "a very smart recommendation by Don and Tommy to put certain elements in place that could easily be removed, and it could be done so in a way that was quiet, so that we didn't create a lot of noise and anxiety, and were necessary for no matter what the war plan eventually evolved into." He carefully added, "The prepositioning of forces should not be viewed as a commitment on my part to use military." He acknowledged with a terse, "Right, yep," that the Afghanistan war and war on terrorism provided the excuse that it was done covertly and that it was expensive. Some of the funding would come from the supplemental appropriations bill being worked out in Congress for the Afghanistan war and the general war on terrorism. The rest would come from old appropriations. By the end of July, Bush had approved some 30 projects that would eventually cost $700 million. Congress, which is supposed to control the purse strings, had no real knowledge or involvement, had not even been notified that the Pentagon wanted to reprogram money. On July 28th and 29th, The Washington Post and New York Times had carried front-page stories on Iraq war planning. In a private talk with the president, Rice said that the leaks in the media, with a different plan almost every day, had become so ludicrous that they were useful. "One good thing about this is that I'm sure Saddam is by now totally confused." With the presidential finding authorizing covert action and allocation of the money, Tenet was ready to send two small CIA paramilitary teams into northern Iraq. He felt emboldened by the agency's success in the Afghanistan war. The survey team that had been sent in during February to assess the security situation said it was feasible, and Tenet had the necessary money, at least $189 million. This was a big change from his days in the Clinton administration. He felt that Clinton had always fucked the agency on money. The new factor was the absence of doubt at the top. Bush displayed no hesitation or uncertainty. Suddenly there seemed to be no penalty for taking risks and making mistakes. So he was going to give it a whack. "It's the Wild West," was Tim's first thought in the second week of July 2002, as he and seven other CIA operatives made the 10-hour overland drive from Turkey into Iraq in a convoy of land cruisers, jeeps, and a truck. Tim was in his late 30s, 6'1", with black hair and a boyish, dashing, even movie star-like smile. He was going to be the designated CIA base chief for Suleymaniye in the mountainous region roughly midway between Baghdad and the Turkish border to the north. His base inside Iraq was some 125 miles from the Turkish border, several miles from the Iranian border. Fluent in Arabic, Tim was a former Navy SEAL. In all, 8 CIA men went in, 4 in Tim's team and 4 headed for a base closer to Turkey. Winning permission from the Turks had required a half-lie. The teams were essentially for counter-terrorism, the CIA told the Turks, intending to focus on the threat represented by Ansar al-Islam, a radical terrorist group that violently opposed the secular Kurdish parties and allegedly ran poison laboratories in a village in Iraq close to the Iranian border. The group had links to al-Qaeda. Tim's team set up its base camp nearby. They were a 45-second helicopter ride from the forward lines of Saddam's military units at his stronghold of Kirkuk. Living conditions were spare. The team had no air support or medical evacuation capability. It would require 24-hour notice to get any of them out. Tim had a wife and small children, and it was not clear whether the team would be there weeks, months, or longer. Tim's core mission was to begin to develop an operational base for covert action to overthrow Saddam. Saul, the Iraqi operations chief, had issued the oral instructions, "I want Saddam's military penetrated. I want the intel service penetrated. I want the security apparatus penetrated. I want tribal networks inside Iraq who will do things for us. Paramilitary, sabotage, ground intelligence. Work the relationship with the Kurds. See if it is feasible to train and arm them so they can tie down Saddam's forces in the north." The CIA had long-standing but tense relations with the Kurdish group, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, the PUK, which controlled the area. The PUK leader, Jalal Talabani, headed 1.2 million Kurds who were impoverished but educated and wanted Saddam out. Tim and the team began interviewing refugees and defectors from Saddam's regime who had fled to the Kurdish area. Two were of particular interest. One was an active-duty Iraqi military officer who had piloted Iraq's French Mirage jets. A second was a mechanic on the MiG-29s. He had extensive data on the collapse of the Iraqi Air Force, which could now essentially perform only kamikaze missions. Iraqi pilots were inventing illnesses on the days they were supposed to fly because they were terrified the inadequately maintained planes would crash. Tim's team established that the Iraqis were running agents into the Kurdish area to find the CIA men and kill them. One of his penetrations of Ansar al-Islam reported that the group was casing the region for Americans who could be ambushed on the roads. Tim danced, threatened, questioned, begged, cajoled, lied, pushed, and attempted to distinguish true from false. One day near the end of August, one of the Kurds who had verifiable gold-plated connections to the PUK inner circle approached Tim. "The PUK isn't treating me as well as they should be," he said. "I really want to help you guys." Tim started working with the guy, listening, questioning. "You know there is this large religious group," the man said, "and they're willing to help." It was a group that had been particularly repressed and savaged by Saddam throughout Iraq, north, south, west, along the borders, in Baghdad. The group was strange, fanatical even, but they were hungry for power. But several days later, near the end of August, the Turks slammed the hammer down hard. Tim's team and the other CIA team were yanked out. As Tim careened down the treacherous mountains in his SUV on what passed for roads, he could not anticipate that he would soon be back and that he had already set in motion a chain of events that would eventually result in unprecedented and controversial intelligence reports that would wind up in the hands of George W. Bush in the Oval Office, and that the agent reports, dubbed with the CIA crypt DB/Rockstars, would be the triggering event for Bush to start war. At 4:30 p.m. on Monday, August 5th, Franks, carrying 110 slides of top-secret polo-step war planning, and Renouart, his Black Book of Death in tow, arrived at the White House Situation Room to brief the President and the National Security Council. The agenda included the introduction of a new concept called the hybrid, a blending of the generated and running start war plans. The hybrid concept was an attempt to take the best from the generated and running starts and factor in the preparatory actions he had taken up to that point. The hybrid plan shrank the front end dramatically, the time allotted to move forces before offensive military operations began. The hybrid had four phases. Phase 1, 5 days to establish the air bridge. Phase 2, 16 days of air attacks and special forces operations. Phase 3, 125 days of decisive combat operations. Phase 4, stability operations of unknown duration. Franks described the advantages of the hybrid concept. Time could be optimized. The quicker force posturing would improve short-term capabilities in the region and the increased pressure on the Iraqi regime could enhance diplomacy, Frank said. I like the concept, Bush said. Best seller, Renouart wrote in the Black Book of Death. We need to have humanitarian assistance on the battlefield from day one, the president said. Slide 35 was titled, Examining Things That Could Go Wrong, Strategic Risks. One was an early missile attack by Saddam on Kuwait. More would have to be done to protect Israel. Franks listed as another risk the possibility of early success. Suppose Saddam walked away or fled, and hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops were flowing into the area. Did they have a legal basis to occupy the country? What if Saddam folded and retreated with his Republican Guard to Baghdad and circled the wagons? Bush once again expressed particular concern about this possibility. Baghdad had more than 5 million people. Other unanswered questions included, what if Iraq just sort of implodes and someone kills Saddam? What would the U.S. do? It was pretty much agreed that the U.S. would still have to enter Iraq with the military because they would not know who the new Iraqi leader might be. Could they trust someone new? Probably not. Did they want to deal with that chaos? They would have to continue the flow of forces and put a military force in to maintain stability. Discussion turned to the Phase 4 stability operations after combat was completed, the number of troops it would take. Franks noted that if the military attack was carried out, they might have up to 265,000 troops in the country. Over time, he would want to draw that down to about 50,000. That would be governed by events in Iraq, but he anticipated the drawdown would occur over 18 months after the end of combat. Powell was very much on edge. The discussions of Iraq were increasingly focused on military planning, a continuing, escalating series of ideas, concepts, detailed sequences, scenarios, and worries. The packet of top-secret slides grew with each of Rumsfeld's and Frank's briefings. Like a proctor at a boys' prep school, Rumsfeld handed out the packets of slides or multicolored sheets and collected them afterward. The president's packet often contained more backup material. Rumsfeld ordered those present not to take notes. He took all the copies back to the Pentagon and had his military assistant lock them in a safe in the Defense Secretary's suite of offices. In the days before the latest Franks briefing unveiling the hybrid concept, Powell had been in Asia making his rounds. He could almost hear the war tom-toms across the ocean. Brent Scowcroft, who had been national security advisor to Bush's father during the Gulf War, had declared on a Sunday morning talk show that an attack on Iraq could turn the entire Middle East into a cauldron and thus destroy the war on terrorism. Powell basically agreed with that blunt warning. Powell talked with Rice. It was impossible to have a complete discussion about Iraq during a meeting that was essentially a military briefing, he said. I really need to have some private time with him to go over some issues that I don't think he's gone over with anyone yet, he insisted. Bush invited Powell and Rice to the residence the evening of Frank's August 5th hybrid briefing. The meeting expanded to include dinner in the family dining room and then continued in the president's office in the residence. By the time they were in Bush's office, Powell was on a roll. You're going to be the proud owner of 25 million people, he told the president. You will own all their hopes, aspirations, and problems. You'll own it all. Privately, Powell and Armitage called this the Pottery Barn Rule. You break it, you own it. He did not feel the downsides had been brought out in sufficient gory detail. The president listened, asked some questions, but did not push back that much. Finally, he looked at Powell. What should I do? What else can I do? Powell realized he needed to offer a solution. You can still make a pitch for a coalition or UN action to do what needs to be done, he said. Bush said he had loved building an international coalition for the Afghanistan war. What would the Russians or the French do? Powell said he thought the U.S. could bring most countries along. There was an additional consideration, he said. If you take it to the UN, you've got to recognize that they might be able to solve it, in which case there's no war. That could mean a solution that is not as clean as just going in and taking the guy out. The president thanked him after 2 hours, an extraordinary amount of time for Powell without static from Cheney and Rumsfeld. 16 months later, in the office where Powell had made his case, I asked the president about Powell's argument that a military solution would mean he would own Iraq. "He sure did," Bush replied. "He did say that." "Your reaction?" I asked, expecting him to articulate an understanding of the case against war. "And my reaction to that is that my job is to secure America," the president said, "and that I also believe that freedom is something people long for, and if given a chance, the Iraqis over time would seize the moment. My frame of mind is focused on what I told you, the solemn duty to protect America." I sat there somewhat nonplussed as the president discussed the issues of freedom and security, which were very much beside the points Powell had made. "And he's talking tactics, though," I began to ask. "That's his job," Bush answered, "to be tactical. My job is to be strategic." Basically, what he was saying was that if in fact Saddam is toppled by military invasion, we better have a strong understanding about what it's going to take to rebuild Iraq. That was certainly true, and it was part of Powell's message, but as I listened, I glimpsed what Powell had apparently seen, uncertainty that the president fully grasped the potential consequences. Events had rendered a number of Powell's concerns moot by December 2003, when I interviewed the president. Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia appeared stable, oil prices hadn't spiked, and the U.S. had found allies for basing in the region. Of the August 2002 period, the president also said,